Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, anyone in between and all those still trying to figure it the fuck out, please sit back, relax, put in your earphones, and buckle your seatbelts. The next 2 hours are guaranteed to not be safe for work. Now welcome to your speakers, smartphones, or laptop, America's sweetheart, Pollo Del Mar, and San Francisco's blazing beauty, Pearl Tees. It's time for Podomatic's number one ranked LGBT podcast, and 120 minutes of your life you will never get back. Brought to you in conjunction with San Francisco's Left Magazine, it's time for Party Foul Radio with Pollo and Pearl.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Party Foul Radio. I'm Pollo Del Mar.
And I'm Pearl Tees.
And this is episode 62, everyone.
All right, 62.
Yes. So this is our episode after Easter. And of course, those of you who have been keeping up with our recent podcast know that Pearl was one of the entertainers at Easter in the Park with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence here in San Francisco.
Sanctuary.
How was it, Pearl?
Sanctuary was amazing. There was, even though, despite the rain, you guys, it was raining.
Ugly.
And I was just like, oh my God, these girls are still going to go hard at it. I get there and there's still a ton of people there. It was incredible. They had all kinds of really cool bands go up. They had live singers. I had a good time. When I got there, I was a little skeptical, but I mean, I got through it. It was fun. The sisters were amazing. Our girl Roma was there.
Roma looked gorgeous. That outfit that she had on, remember the floral?
Her face was painted for filth, girl. And so was her little boa was cute, too.
But I just remember, the floral, was it the floral flowy?
Yeah, that's
caftan type
thing? I don't think I would have worn that considering the weather, but she did it, girl.
Whatever, girl. It was gorgeous. Roma, you looked beautiful, bitch.
So that was fun. It was a full weekend for me. The previous night, I was actually at Oasis for
the
Beyonce
tribute
night. Mm-hmm. And that was a full house. And then Sunday night, I had Sayoni's birthday at the Glamazon.
Yep.
So it was a full weekend for me. I took Monday off for a mental health day, girl.
Good for you. And you need mental health. You need help. Yep. So anyway, you guys, I was in Sacramento on Friday night with MGM Grand and Miss Shugana, Mad Dog 2020, Land of Lakes, Euphoria. Oh my God, I'm probably leaving somebody out. They're going to be livid. But anyway, we were all up there and we had a really good time. Relentless was in the show with us. It was a private gig. So we did this nice little fun night. I had a really good time. Girl, while I was up there, of course, you know, every gay knows that when you go out of town, girl, you turn on Grindr to see who's around. I sure was trying to chat up. Well, you're not gay.
I know. So, but I mean, even when not Sacramento, boo.
Well, first of all, I think the men in Sacramento are hot. The men in Sacramento are hot, and I don't see them very often, so they're fresh faces. But anyway, how about I was chatting up Alexis Michelle from Drag Race on Grindr.
I am so sorry.
She was in town. I thought she was just so cute as a boy.
Speaking of which, can we talk about her real quick? Girl, I remember when the promos and stuff came out, I was like, oh, she's I liked her style and everything. But every time she has an opinion about something on the show, how about it's completely off? She thinks someone is in the bottom two or whatever, and that person wins the challenge. And it's just like, girl, you should just sit back and just keep your mouth shut. I want to like her. I really do. But, girl, she's one of those queens that just... Well, she's not as annoying as Eureka on the show.
No.
But she is right after her at this point. Jesus.
Okay.
So she's actually, she's kind of in up there with Aja. I think between those two, girl, get all three of them off.
So Pearl has taken us right. I was going to eventually work our way into a recap of Drag Race, but we're already here, girl. So
yes,
let's just go for it. So the most recent episode, of course, had the contestants producing a morning talk show type of thing. It was, so everybody gets cast.
Yep.
They had Aja as the team Valentina, captain yeah. of one, and Valentina is team captain of the other. No. Aja is one, and
Trinity.
Trinity is the captain, right.
Oh, that was so hard to watch.
So they have the girls, they pair them up, everybody gets all paired up or whatever, and so then they do the talk show, and you guys, we're going to be giving spoilers, so this is your spoiler alert warning. Like, I'm going to put a siren or some shit in here. This is your spoiler alert, because if you haven't seen it...
Girl, fast forward.
Yeah, so anyway, it comes down to the bottom two in their lip sync for their life are Trinity.
Ugh.
Because Trinity was, like, got stuck in some bad character decision making that they decided that their characters were going to have some backstory, and it was it was a mess. Bitch,
but she looked the best on the runway.
And then the other bottom contestant was Charlie Hyde, which was a little surprising because Charlie Hyde, going into it, has, like, she's done what she calls chat shows. Like, she's done talk shows in the UK, and she's got this experience. But it was absolutely dreadful. Like, I don't, you know, it seemed dreadful. So, they end up in the bottom two, which presents, you know, a whole different series of things. But, rewinding a little bit, during the show itself, they, of course, Charlie Hyde gets this moment in where she's talking about, like, the history of HIV and AIDS and how her generation was impacted by it. And Cuckoo is like, oh, we young people support, like, you know, appreciate your, like, memories of this time or whatever. And my cuckoo. But what blew me away, Pearl, I don't know if you noticed this. How about the person on the entire show? I thought Charlie Hyde would be, like, the voice of reason because she's older. The voice of reason on the entire fucking show has turned out to be Valentina.
Kind of, yeah.
But
she's been, like, she's been the most, like, trying to stay out of drama, I feel like.
But she was the one who was like, you guys, can we just focus on whatever? But do you remember then, like, Eureka made some comment or whatever?
Of course.
And who was the one who got upset with Eureka and they were, like, going at it? Like, no, you shouldn't be so rude. And then the dressing room was...
Girl, everyone goes at it with Eureka.
But, oh, it was... Who was the one who was like, I have eating disorders and everybody tells me I'm so skinny. Who was that?
Oh, that was Sasha Velour.
So Eureka makes a comment about, like, everybody having issues, and she says, like, hers was eating her food or something like that. And then Sasha Velour is like, well, you don't know how many times people have asked me if I'm anorexic, and it's hurtful or whatever. And the thing was, like, I don't know. I'm just going to be honest. Everything Eureka does annoys me, to be honest.
Right.
But the thing about it, the one thing I will agree with, Sasha Velour said, you know what? Because she comes over, and she's like, well, I didn't mean to upset you, and I'm sorry or whatever. And then... But she doesn't leave it at that. Like, then she goes, what do you want me to do? Get on my knees and blah, 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 blah. And Sasha says, that doesn't sound like an apology to me.
Right.
And that's where I had to agree. Because, you guys, my understanding of an apology to somebody is that you say, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. And then you let them say whatever they're going to say.
Yeah, you don't say, I'm sorry that you feel that way.
Well,
that's what she said. That is not an apology.
Well, like,
you can't apologize for me feeling a certain way.
Right. I had an incident like this where I said something while I was in drag, and a friend of mine on the way to Sacramento confronted me about it. And I said, you know what? That was not my intent to make you or anyone else feel that way. It was a comment. I can't retract it. I probably wouldn't, but my intention wasn't to hurt you or anyone else. Like, you're entitled to feel how you're going to feel. I don't have to, like, defend my behavior. I can say, you know what?
You can say, I'm sorry that it came off that way. That's not what I meant.
Or you can just say, you know what? My intention wasn't to hurt anybody's feelings.
That's the way to avoid an apology. If you want to do that, yeah.
To say, my intent was not to hurt your feelings?
Yeah, that's not an apology.
But
that's just explaining yourself.
No, it's not. It's not explaining yourself. It's like, you know what? I don't take back... Because the thing is, like... I often say things that I actually mean, but my intention is not to, like, hurt somebody's feelings.
So that's just explaining yourself.
No, it's not. It's like, you know what? My intention was, I apologize for hurting your feelings. That wasn't my intent. Period.
But that's not what you said.
My intent was not to hurt your feelings. So, yeah. like, I'm sorry that I hurt your feelings.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. You're just explaining, you know, that's not what you meant.
I mean, my thing with it is, like, I'm not one to say, like, unless it's, like, something like, well, that is not what I was saying at all. You know, like, I don't need to explain away my whatever. I can just say, you know what? Like, yeah, I said that, and my intent wasn't to hurt your feelings, and if that's what happened, I'm sorry, but, I mean, I don't think that is not being an apology. It's like, you know what?
I think that's more of an explanation, not an apology.
But the thing is, like, I think that, you know, in general, like, to apologize for something that you say or do, if you're not, like, if you're not...
If you don't want to apologize, girl, then yeah.
No, but I'm saying, like, I don't think that there's a lot of times that an individual doesn't, like, I actually meant that, or I, like, I'm not sorry that I did that, but the intention was not to hurt your feelings. Like, I'm sorry it hurt your feelings. That wasn't the intent, and I'm sorry that you were hurt. Like, that is an apology.
Yeah, if you say, I'm sorry you were hurt, that's an apology.
But, I mean, it's like, that wasn't the intention, and I'm sorry if that's how it came across.
I mean, if you say, I'm sorry,
but
whatever.
I think that, like, I think that certain people think that, like, for an individual to apologize, it means that they have to, like, retract what was said or whatever. And most of the time, I won't do that. Because
you're not sorry.
I'm sorry that somebody was hurt, but, like, I'm not sorry, like, that things were said or whatever. Like, if somebody was hurt and that wasn't the intent, then yeah, that's like an unfortunate byproduct that was not intended of a situation. But I mean, like, in this situation, going back to the situation on Drag Race, Eureka was over there, like, where Eureka, like, went completely off the rails when she's like, what do you want me to do, grovel on the floor, get on my knees, blah blah blah. It's just like, you know what, it all you have to do is be like, girl, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings, sorry. Like, go on. But, like,
right.
Eureka works my puss anyway, so.
Yeah, I don't know whose puss she doesn't work.
So,
I am a little disappointed that, I don't remember if it was on the actual show or if it was on Untucked, but Charlie Hyde mentioned that during Snatch Game she was going to do Joan Rivers. And I think that would have been brilliant.
Yeah.
That sucks. We're not going to be able to see that.
Well, Charlie Hyde goes home, you guys, because...
Girl, she gave up.
She literally didn't do anything. She just stood there and, like, occasionally moved a hand or something while lip-syncing to Britney Spears.
Yeah.
And this is my feedback on that thought. This is my thought on that situation. She said her excuse was, well, in the UK, we all sing live. We don't actually lip-sync. Well, that's fucking fine. Most girls go on the show and they don't actually sing live. But when that's the challenge, bitch, you rise to the occasion.
Right. Mariah Balenciaga wasn't a lip singer when she was on, but when it was time for her to lip sync, she lip synced.
When you're on there, if you want to be on there, you do what you have to do to stay. And that means if you have to do something that's out of your comfort zone, such as lip sync, you fucking damn well do it.
Right, which is why I think Trinity Taylor really is going to go far, because she's already, like, done all this other stuff that's just not her typical drag. Like, she gets her job, the job done.
Well, again, I'm still not a huge fan of Trinity Taylor. I don't know why. She just doesn't do a lot for me. I know, in fact, I was talking about this today with friends. My sister Becky Motor Lodge loves her. Like, a lot of people really like her. They really connect to her. In terms of personality, she does not do a great deal for me. But this episode, she did get, like, bonus points from me, because when they were on the runway and they were of course, needless to say, asked to choose somebody that they felt should be eliminated. And when it came time, because she was the team captain, she said, you know what? I'm the team captain. If there was something that where my team fell short, I'm going to assume responsibility for that because I was the captain. Right. And then Peppermint actually said, you know what? I'm going to take responsibility too. So they both got, like, I just like people who take some responsibility, because usually bitches so fucking willing to pass the buck. And then, needless to say, Eureka, well, I think that Trinity should go home because blah blah. And Trinity said, wait, I'm gonna call shade on this one. So, you know, I again, like, I'm not, I mean, you know, the thing was, like, what Trinity was saying, I really believe is, like, I've already taken I'm accepting responsibility for this and that are my doing, but I think she's trying to push some shit off on me.
Right.
And there's a motive behind it. She's bitter Betty because right. she lost in pageants to me. So, what are your bets, Pearl, that eventually Eureka and Trinity are going to lip sync for their life against each other?
No, I don't think Trinity's going to end up in the bottom too often.
I'm not saying she's going to end up in the bottom two, but I, like, if they, girl, they're building this thing up to be another Alyssa and Coco, so you know.
Kind of, yeah.
So, if they don't, and it's a missed opportunity, bitch, if they don't, so. But, to be honest, if Trinity can send Eureka packing, I'll be really, she'll increase her value to me as a fan favorite. Because, but I'm still, I really enjoyed, I will say that Eureka and Nina Bonina Brown, when they were together doing their segment of the chat show, the talk show, I thought they were very good. Where Nina Bonina's you know, being ridiculous, and she's like, you can make this weave out of ramen noodles.
Right, so that was good. But the best one, I think, clearly was, it was Sasha Velour and Shea Coulee. They were brilliant.
What were they again? I don't remember. Like,
they did almost the same thing, but they kind of flirted with each other the entire time.
Oh, I don't know. I thought that was I thought it was a little awkward.
Sometimes. I thought it was fucking hilarious.
So, I don't
know.
It
had their own team members, like, breaking character.
So, I mean, I think that it'll be interesting to see it continue. I think that next episode is Kardashian the Musical. Is that what I...
Yeah, I'm guessing probably one of the Kardashians is going to be a special guest judge.
Lord.
Right.
Whatever. So... I don't know. That will be something, all right. That'll be something, all right. I can't say much because actually, the last time a Kardashian was on the show, it was Chloe. Yeah. And I immediately, that night, after it aired, sent a text to Kipper and had her costume recreated for me.
Of course. So
it was sickening. She looked sickening. I loved it. Anyway, so that's our recap of this RuPaul's Drag Race. I am even more firmly behind my appreciation for Nina. I really, really like Shay, and I really, really like Peppermint. So,
you know, I love Peppermint's personality, but girl, her styling is off. She is just, I think she's probably going to be gone within the next 2 to 3 episodes.
Really?
Girl, her styling is off.
Wait, was Peppermint the one who had that pink nightie that was, I did not love that look. So that
girl, I didn't even like that look.
The runway was like negligee and, type of thing or whatever.
You know, another thing that's really starting to, like, I don't know if they're telling her she should dress a certain way, but even outside of the challenges, they have her in like men's sportswear. And I think that's weird. And I feel like that takes away from her being visibly, like, a trans woman on the show.
I did not get the impression, though, before her being announced as a member of this season, that she was visibly trans. Like, I'm not sure that when she went on, that was how she presented.
I think that, well, maybe.
I honestly, like, I think that she presented male up until the point that they filmed everything, and then probably, like, was like, by the way!
Yeah.
So.
Well, it just goes further to show, and, girl, speaking of trans and in RuPaul's Drag Race, Trinity Taylor, girl, the body on her is so amazing. Now,
not a fan. Like, for the very reason that you're about to say, because she's like a pair of breasts away from a woman, like, in terms of, like,
I mean, as far as, like, if you were to judge by looks, yeah,
body,
right? Her body is sickening. But I mean, that just goes to show that, you know, even trans women should be able to compete on the show, because we got men out here getting surgery on the show,
well,
left and right, you know what I mean?
And again, I'm not a huge fan of that, so you know, like, I do understand what you're saying, and I just am not a fan of the fact that she's, like, so surgically enhanced that, Yeah.
Yeah, but girl detox was too.
Yes. I don't think she was quite as surgically enhanced on her season as she was on All Stars, but I think she was. But she was, well, I mean,
she probably went and got more.
Yeah, but exactly. I mean. She definitely increased the surgeries for that. But I'm not a fan. I think it's a totally different scenario. So, but whatever. It is what it is. I will say that in terms of the looks on the runway for the negligee or what, I don't know what the fuck they listed as, like evening right. wear, night wear,
lingerie.
I thought it was funny because they were like, they said that Cynthia Lee Fontaine didn't read as lingerie. I'm like, she's literally got the Victoria's Secret angel wings on. I'm almost certain that's why she wore them, because Victoria's Secret like runway models always had the fucking white wings
they
on.
They were awful though. Red is really tacky.
Well, that whole team was dreadful, like in terms of their negligee looks. Yeah. And like, whatever.
Whose team was she on?
She was on the team that was in the bottom.
Trinity's. But Trinity looked the best.
So
Trinity was like, I thought Trinity like had the best costume.
Well, I thought Charlie Hyde like looked beautiful for that challenge too.
She wore white, right?
She wore like
something real airy.
Like a long like a chiffon-y robe type of thing. She looked lovely.
She did.
And thank God she looked lovely, because while she was standing there doing nothing, she looked gorgeous at least. So there you have it. But
right. Anyway.
All right, you guys, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with more gossip on this episode of Party Foul Radio. Plus, we've got two great interviews for you. We are going to have Max Gogarty, who is the director of the documentary Chemsex, which is all about the impact of crystal meth on gay male sex and the ramifications of that. The film is actually going to be doing two showings. Oh my gosh.
Jesus, girl.
Sorry.
Bless you.
Thank you, Queef. So the show is going to actually be having two airings in the San Francisco Bay Area. One in this coming Saturday, the 22nd in Oakland, California, and one on the 23rd at the Women's Building in San Francisco. And I will be on the panel for that. We're going to talk to Max about that later in this episode. Plus, emerging rap / alternative pop star Kay Flay is going to be on with us talking about her brand new album, which just dropped last week. All that and much more on Party Foul Radio. I'm Poet Almar.
And I'm Pearl Tease.
And we'll be back in a moment.
Oh, she really came that way?
All right. I need to
get up in this gear, girl.
My name is Alyssa Edwards, and this is Party Foul Radio.
I don't get cute. I get drop-dead gorgeous.
All right, you guys, we are back with more Party Foul Radio. Sorry, my voice cracked there like Peter Brady when he went through puberty on the Brady Bunch.
Oh.
I'm Poet Almar.
And I'm Pearl Teeth.
Oh, over the weekend, you guys, it was the Miss Continental pageant, which is...
It was Continental Plus and Continental Elite.
Elite.
And that's exactly what it sounds like. Continental Plus is for the plus-sized divas.
And Elite, I think, is for older.
It's for the older divas.
They're over 40. How very dare they?
I love it.
How very dare you?
So they already have crowned...
Miss Elite.
Miss Elite. And it is Fantasia. It's Miss Fantasia L'Amour. So congratulations, Miss Fantasia L'Amour. And then for the plus division, finals are tonight. I don't know who the top 10 are. I do know a few ladies that went up there to compete, or over there to compete, including Savannah Summers, Shaniqua Vault.
Girl, okay.
Hold on, I can tell you a whole list of the girls. There was a total of 24 girls.
For plus?
For plus.
Okay.
Bella Sky, Savannah Summers, Angel Devereaux, Trixie Deluxe, Summer Breeze, Desiree St. James, Kiki Velasquez Lord, Monica Dupree. I've competed against her.
That's because you're plus, I guess.
You know, everything's plus about this. Ariana DeCardeza, Cash Monet,
Debonair. Wait, Cash Monet?
Not Cash Monet.
It's okay, a Cash. One. Okay.
Jasmine Lysh LaBeija.
The House of LaBeija, bitch! Yeah. Don't make me vogue up in this motherfucker!
They're usually pretty fierce, girl. Sage Summers, Layla LaRue, Silk and Ganache, Venus Knight, Aspen Love, Janice Colby, Georgia B. Cummings. I've competed against her, too. Brianna Nicole, Shaniqua Volz, Lavelle LaCroix, Armani Nicole Davenport, and Crystal Bell.
All right. Well, girls, you better get your plus-size divas on.
Right. I've been waiting for them to at least announce people who've made the finals, but I guess they probably don't even announce that until tonight.
Girl. Okay. Well, good luck to all the ladies who are competing at Continental. In the United States, Continental is one of the premier pageants, primarily for trans women. I think it's, isn't it primarily trans?
No. Nope.
I thought that that was the one where boobs were encouraged.
They're not encouraged, but you can have them. You definitely can have them.
So, well, good luck to all the ladies who are competing for Continental. When I lived in the Midwest, girl, Continental was what everybody was about.
Have you ever been to a Continental pageant?
I have not.
I want to. I think I might. I'm going to try to go next year.
So, the bitches of Continental turn it out, though, girl.
They give you. That is a show, girl.
I mean.
That's a, like, production back.
I do know that I'm trying to remember what her last name was. She was a huge star in the Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas scene. Whitney Cummings was a former Miss Continental Plus, and she was just incredible. She's departed now, but she passed away a few years back, but just an incredible performer. And I had the opportunity to see her before she passed. She hosted a show at the biggest LGBT nightclub and show bar in Little Rock, Arkansas. I was there with my girl Taylor Madison Monroe, and who is a former Miss Gay United States and former Miss Gay Arkansas. And it was for her step down that I was there. And then Whitney was the co-MC of that. And then she went over and hosted her own show next door. It's this huge complex. It's like three bars in one. It was incredible. Come on now. I like.
All right.
Girl, in the South, in the Midwest too, like they give you.
Girl, they throw down, girl.
Yes, they sure do. And
so for those of you that don't know, Miss Continental happens obviously every year. It's a pageant. It was founded in 1980 by Jim Flint. And it happens over in Chicago.
Chicago, yes.
And the actual Miss Continental, I'll try to see if I can figure that out for you guys, but I don't believe that's happened yet.
So, Continental is...
It's one of the biggest pageants in the United States.
It's one of the biggest pageants in the world, girl, I'm pretty sure. So, anyway, congratulations once again to all the ladies who are there competing. Good luck to you all, because a win at Continental, girl, is a life-changing experience.
Right, girl, I think they give you a credit card.
So... Meanwhile, while we were taking our little break, I got an email from Terry McLaughlin here in San Francisco, who is the coordinator of Design Meets Divas of Drag. And I've competed 2 years in the Design Meets Divas of Drag pageant. I will tell you, I don't take the Design Meets Divas of Drag pageant quite as seriously as I would other pageants, because a lot of it has to do with things that are kind of beyond your control. You're paired up with a designer. And anyway, Mercedes Monroe is the reigning Miss Design Meets Divas of Drag, and Katya Smirnoff-Sky.
I didn't realize that was a pageant. I thought that was just like a fashion show they put together.
It's a fashion show, but they crown a winner and a first and second runner-up.
Oh, okay.
So, I absolutely love my outfit from last year. I didn't give a fuck if I didn't win or not, because I love the outfit.
And you got it for free, right?
I got it for free. You know, if I had been taking the competition element of it a lot more seriously, I'd have been livid, because I don't know what happened. My music cut in and out like 5 times at one point. I was basically pantomiming up on there. But they are already in the pre-planning stages. It looks like Design Meets Divas of Drag will be happening on Friday, September 15th.
Oh, so you got some time. Do you know who you're being paired up with?
I don't know any of that, but I'm looking forward to it because they do this once a year. I get a sickening outfit out of it. I've got two outfits that I absolutely love. I took my costume from the first Design Meets Divas of Drag when I went to the Ultimate Panache pageant in Hawaii. And I spent a lot of time making that outfit a lot nicer, sprucing it up.
Roxy Cotton Candy did the same thing.
Yes.
And she, for the UPP pageant, but it was a sister.
No, it was, or something. It was this. The UPP pageant has three pageants actually in one night. One is the called the Jewel of the Galaxy, which is the one Roxy competed in. Yeah. And won. Mm-hmm. Mine was the Ultimate Showgirl. Say it's three pageants in one night, and then they have the male category. And Roxy used her outfit from that competition. And
that outfit was sickening.
Yeah, well, I mean, she added to it a lot too.
Yeah, with that hair.
Well, the hair is because they did a hair odyssey.
Yeah,
that was one of their categories. Ours was Ultimate Showgirl, which is feathers and whatever. And Roxy's was a hair odyssey. It was a little different, but similar. So anyway, that is coming to San Francisco, you guys, on Friday, September 15th. It's going to be at the Design Center in San Francisco. It's always a really good time. It sells out. It's incredible. So,
speaking of Roxy in San Francisco, she's back in the city. Have you seen her since?
Yep.
Isn't that like your drag sister? Oh. Well, never mind.
Moving right along. So, but I'm looking at the list of contestants here that they possibly have, and some of the people that could be competing in this Ultimate Showgirl, I'm sorry, this Design Meets Divas of Drag would include Persia Socrates.
Persia, I love me some Persia, girl.
Vanity Eatonov, Rhea Light, Kamara Rouge, Honey Mahogany, Madison McQueen, Paju Monroe, Kylie Minogue, and
it sounds like the same people that do it every year.
It is the same people, so hopefully one of these years it'll be my year, bitch! Yes! No.
Well, I mean, you only have so many people that they continuously book.
Well, girl, but people could potentially, you know, win more than once. I don't know. Girl, anyway, so...
But you know what? That's probably a pageant I probably wouldn't want to win, so I could continue to run again next year.
Okay, keep getting the outfits. Yeah, that's why I'm like...
I'm okay if I lose, girl.
You just design something fierce, bitch, and I'll come out there and fail for us.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Right.
I don't give a damn. So, anyway, that's what's going on with that front. Oh, I want to pimp out some things that are going to be coming up on future episodes of Party Foul Radio.
Come through.
Next episode, you guys, it's already recorded, but it will not be this episode. This morning, I sat down and interviewed, by FaceTime, my buddy over in the UK. You guys know him as chart-topping singer, one half of Erasure. Andy Bell is going to be on with us next week. He and Vince of Erasure have a new album coming in May, and I'm super excited. You know, they definitely were groundbreaking in terms of queer musicians, and they, you know, 30 years into their career, they're still making incredible music together. So Andy Bell will be on next episode of Party Foul Radio talking about the new Erasure album. And this morning, you guys, I don't know how it happened, but I was like looking around and I saw an interview on Fox News or some shit, mm-hmm, of all places, with Erin Murphy. And she is the actress who, as a child, played Tabitha on the TV show Bewitched. Okay. Like the little daughter.
Uh-huh.
And so she is part of this new web series, and it's called Life Interrupted. It's like it's basically like a web sitcom, except for the fact that the webisodes are like 7 minutes long, so they're very short. So when you watch multiple ones, it's like watching one sitcom.
Okay.
But the entire cast of Life Interrupted is made up of former child stars, or people who have had iconic roles on other TV shows that... sort of like the idea of the Life Interrupted, it plays to the idea that these people had like this tremendous success and then sort of like their life calmed down and they went back to real life. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So of course, Erin Murphy was on Bewitched as basically a baby. I think she started around 3 or 4 years old on the show and was maybe like up to 8 or 9 on the show.
All right.
And it stars other people like, the actress who played Nellie Olson on Little House on the Prairie.
Okay.
It has Dawn Wells, who played Marianne on Gilligan's Island.
Okay.
I really like her character, by the way. She, you know, we got to know her as like this sweet, like little farmer's daughter type of thing, mm-hmm, on Gilligan's Island. But she is playing sort of this vixen-esque mother, like this older woman who's like cougary, you know what I mean? She's like, and the one of the things of note about this series is that the actress who plays Nellie Olson and the actress who played Tabitha, Erin Murphy, are a lesbian couple on the show.
Oh, right.
So, I...
Yes, lesbians.
Yes, come on, lesbian couple on a webisode. So, anyway, I contacted Erin Murphy this morning, and she got back to me right away about doing an interview with us.
She's gonna do it.
Yeah.
I'm so juiced for that.
Yeah, it's very exciting, and... The thing that's, I mean, obviously, this is great to talk about her new project, but one of the things that people don't know is that she's been offered lots of work. You know, they think of her as like this washed up child star or whatever. She's actually been offered lots of work, but she's very particular about what she wants to do.
Girl, yes, I feel that. That is where I'm at right now. Girl, yes.
And she, you know, she's also a mom of 6 kids.
Oh my God.
Girl, right? 6 kids. But the thing that is exciting to me to talk to her is that she is a person who, at a very young age, had this tremendous success on a very popular TV show, which to this day you can see her on because it's in reruns everywhere. Uh-huh. Hello, like Nick at Night and all these other places where they show Bewitched. But what a lot of people I don't think realize within the queer community when we think about this, so she was kind of raised on TV by people who, one of her TV dads... Because they switched out actors 3 years into the show after one of the actors got sick. So one of her TV dads was a gay man who came out very late in life.
Okay.
Her TV grandma, Agnes Moorehead, was rumored to have been a lesbian, which I'm interested in talking about that because some stories conflict with that. And then her TV uncle, Uncle Arthur, was Paul Lynde, who was, like, when I was growing up, one of the few people who was, like, borderline out the whole time. So she was kind of, like, raised by gays on TV. And I'm, you know, while being on this sort of, like, semi-wholesome TV show. So I'm really interested in hearing what it was like from her perspective. I mean, of course, she, you know, she was probably, like, 7 years old. So her perspective might have been a little skewed.
Just a little bit.
But I think it'll be really interesting to have her on. So, oh, and she was like, and by the way, I love your drag name. So.
Wow.
But, you know.
I guess she doesn't have the best taste in the world, but that's fine.
At least she has good taste in roles. So, anyway, that is going to be on an upcoming episode. She emailed me this afternoon, and we're trying to lock down a time for the interview. So, I'm looking forward to that. Also, there is a new video by a British singer named Grace and Lil Yachty, the rapper Lil Yachty.
I don't know rappers that well.
Okay. And his name is DJ Cassidy. They've got a new song out together. The trio of
DJ
Cassidy. So I've locked down.
What's the name of the song?
The song is called Honor, and it literally just came out today.
Huh.
So we're going to have DJ Cassidy on an upcoming episode as well. So a lot of things in the works for upcoming interviews for us, which is all good. And those are all things I just wanted to pimp out to let you guys know that. Some good stuff is upcoming. Have you heard, speaking of things that just came out, have you heard the new Lady Gaga song?
I saw it, and I was tempted to press play, but I didn't, girl. Have you heard it?
I listened to it.
Have a scowl on your face. I have to be honest, though. I didn't like her last album.
Okay, so I didn't like the last album either that much. Joanne is like, yeah, I didn't like it that much. I definitely liked... the first single off of it, and
which was
that one that was like very rocker like. What was the name of that song? Shit,
the only thing I can remember is Million Reasons.
Well, Million Reasons is okay, but to me, Million Reasons literally just sounds like other songs that she's already done. That's one of the problems I actually have with Gaga is a lot of her music to me sounds repetitive.
Uh huh.
So hold on, I'm looking it up. Because I can't, I'm trying to remember the name of that first song off of it. The very first song off of the Joanne album was, Perfect Illusion. I like Perfect Illusion.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I like Perfect Illusion a lot. Anyway, so the new song from Lady Gaga, there's a lot of speculation because she's still touring supporting Joanne. So they're wondering if people, like, critics are asking if it's going to be part of a Joanne reissue, like how they put Bad Romance on a reissue. And, hold on, new song from Lady Gaga, because I can't remember the name of it.
It's like...
It's The Cure. It's called The Cure by Lady Gaga. So, the hold on, let's just see if we can play it here for Pearl. So it's like, it's out now, it's on,
I'll play it, I'll listen to it, girl, don't worry about it. But anyway, what about it?
Well,
did you like it?
Well, I want you to hear it.
Well, I want to know what your opinion is while I hear it.
Well, I'm playing it right now.
Well, you can still tell me your opinion.
Well, I'm sure you guys out there have already heard this, but... What the hell? It sounds like somebody's playing in their bathtub. Right. Jesus Christ, that was a shitty version. That was the official audio? Bitch, that could not possibly be the Lady Gaga version.
No, I found it. That's not it.
This is Wretch. This version. Bitch, stop playing it in the bathtub.
Right.
It's like, you know, that's because they wanted it all muffled and shit so they could try to get some views and make money off of it. Come on, play it, bitch.
Of course I don't get service in your house.
Oh my god. So...
This sounds a lot prettier than what was playing off of your phone.
Yeah.
Oh, I like it so far.
Her vocals sound a lot softer.
I love it. I like it.
The vocals sound a lot softer on this studio version than the live version at Coachella.
Well, I'm sure. I like it. I like it.
I think a lot of people are going to like it.
And I don't even perform Lady Gaga or anything like that, but I would do this.
So, the thing about this track, it reminds me of lots of stuff that's been written. It reminds me of something that would be written for Justin Bieber, like the off the Sorry album. Like, you know, it reminds me of like boy bands. The thing is this. I really.
I don't know, it kind of gives me like a.
I'm trying. There's a song that
throwback feel.
That. Thing reminds me of another song that's out right now. And anyway, so you guys, I think this is what's happening here. So Gaga's realized, you know, Gaga's been doing what Gaga wants to do for a while now.
Of course.
And I think that Gaga recognizes that this last album didn't do exactly what she wanted it to do, I don't think. And I think that, you know, she's recognizing, girl, Billboard magazine referred to her as a nostalgia act. She's been out for like 7 years and they're already calling her a nostalgia act. You guys, a nostalgia act is Cher. Cher is a nostalgia act. Anybody who's been performing...
Even the Spice Girls.
Spice Girls are a nostalgia act. And they're referring to her 7 years into her career as a nostalgia act. That means that...
That's crazy.
Basically, they're saying...
That she left.
Yeah, so what they actually said in this review in Billboard magazine is that nobody expects her to any longer be competing with her contemporaries like Beyonce or da-da-da-da. So, yeah. In other words, meaning her time has passed. Well, I don't think that's true. I think she definitely, like, had, you know, thank God for her that Million Reasons got played at the Oscars or wherever it got played and then shot up into the top 10 because that's her first top 10 in a while and it's done well for her. But... I think that this song is very obviously intended to return her to pop radio. It's a very summery pop feel. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that the idea is to get her back on the radio, to get her back contemporary, and, you know, and then allow her to kind of move forward with her career. I think that the song is, it's very nice. It's a very easy listen. It'll totally be breezy pop music for the summer. I find the song really generic. It sounds like something...
Yeah, it is kind of generic.
I mean, it sounds like something that they would give one of these, like, young pop starlets who, you know, sort of, like, ease their way onto the scene.
Right.
Nothing about this says to me, like, I'm the biggest pop star in the world. you know, and I'm going to put out something that's fresh and different. This, it legit sounds like you could put her in with, like, some of those songs by, like I said, you could put her next to, like, Sorry by Justin Bieber, or you could put her next to some shit by, like,
Zara Larsson, or...
Zara Larsson, or that... It reminds me a little bit of the Chainsmokers.
But everything right now sounds like the Chainsmokers. I was just talking to a friend the other day about how pop music is changing, and I've noticed, because when I perform, I usually perform, like, up-to-date, current right. stuff that's pop.
Current stuff.
And now that pop music, I feel like, has changed a little bit. It's just, like, it doesn't go with what I'm used to, like, performing.
Right. It doesn't resonate with you that way.
Right. So, everything has just sounded like the Chainsmokers lately.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you, like, the other sound that, to me, is really prominent, if you are a male vocalist, they want that Pharrell sound, like, that,
Pharrell? I haven't heard his name in years, girl, what?
Well, how have you not heard Pharrell?
In years.
Bitch, how is that even possible? Like, it's, like, that, the sound that, it's continued, it was, like, Happy by Pharrell, then it was that Robin Thicke song, and then it was, like, that new Ed Sheeran sound. They all have the same exact sound. It's that, like, kind of, like, pseudo-throwback funk sound.
Oh, kind of like Bruno Mars right now.
Bruno Mars was in between, is in that same mix that Justin Bieber has that sound. Like, it's all that, they sound like they wrote one song and then, like, reproduced it for 15 different people. That's the other sound. Or you get that really, it's called Tropical House, that...
Yeah.
It's like something, you're like, I'm sipping a pina colada by the pool, and some bitch is like, you know, it's Tropical House. And the funny thing is, my friend, one of my friends, Matt Consola, has been on this tropical, he's a music producer, and he owns his Swishcraft Records, which put out one of my songs a couple years ago, and he's been on this Tropical House kick for like 2.5 years, and he's like, girl, it's gonna be huge. Well, bitch, it's huge.
Right, girl, keep going, girl. Just keep going and get out of here, girl.
So, but, I mean, it will pass, but it's like, there's this, that's the sound. Like, that's either that, like, throwback funk, like, sound, which has, like, a lot of, like, falsettos in it for if you're a male, or, and then the flip side of that is that, like, light, housey sound that we just heard from Gaga, and Chainsmokers do that light, housey thing, and whatever. So, I'm optimistic that the music will keep progressing and it'll keep shifting. Like, the number of songs that are coming out right now that are, like, you know, I listen to a lot of music, and I'm like, I want to perform something new, but there's not that much stuff that I want to perform new either.
Right, everything that I've been listening to is not stuff that I would perform lately. Like, Ruth B's new album is coming out in May.
Ruth B?
Yeah.
Okay.
She's a beautiful voice. I think she's new on the scene and stuff. She's a pianist. She doesn't really sing, like, upbeat music.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that is coming. I'm sure that, you know, with the onset of summer headed our way, we'll get tons of new shit, because everybody wants to have the song of the summer.
I do live for Betty Who's new album, though.
Betty Who's new album is phenomenal.
I live. She even has Superfruit on there, girl. And I love Superfruit.
Yeah, so, Betty Who is somebody, I just love her voice, and, like, I really like Mama Say. What would your mama say?
Yeah.
What?
Right. I love the entire, it's, I love it.
The album's good. Yeah. The album is good. All right, you guys, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we are going to have, what, bitch?
What would your mama say?
What would your mama say? We're gonna have our first interview. We're going to have on with us, she is a rising multi-genre, she's a genre-defying rising artist.
Multi-threat.
And you can catch her new song, oh God, what is her new song? Higher, I believe is what it's called. I'm still obsessed with her track called Blood in the Cut. Look her up. You guys, her name is Kay Flay. That's K with a period, F-L-A-Y.
Oh,
she'll be on.
Flay.
Come on, Kay Flay. She'll be on with us right after this. You're listening to Party Foul Radio. I'm Poet Omar.
And I'm Pearl Tease.
Hallelujah, this is Shangela, and you're listening to Party Foul Radio with Polio and Pearl, honey. Hallelujah.
Clock the bag.
Clock the bag.
Clock the shoe.
Clock the shoe.
Now punch the clock. It's time to work, 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 work.
Thank you.
Hi, Kay. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm terrific. You know, it was prefaced by telling me before this interview that be prepared. She's a smart cookie. And I said, well, of course. Obviously, she went to Stanford. That's number one. You don't get in there if you're stupid. And number two, like, you can tell by your music that you're intelligent.
Oh, well, thank you. But I don't want to set the bar too high because I'm still, like, I've only had one coffee today. So I'm not running on all my cylinders.
Yeah, not fully caffeinated just yet. So, you know, one of the things that I am very, I'm kind of intrigued by in terms of your musical output is that I first became aware of Blood in the Cut, which I'm obsessed with, and I plan to perform that in drag, by the way. And
oh, amazing. By the way, I've just ran into a friend in LA who was like, I was at a drag show, and they did this amazing version of Blood in the Cut.
Well, I mean, I have this whole vision for it, and when I do it, I'll make sure that you get a link to, like, a video of the performance, so it's kind of conceptual, out of curiosity, what does it make you, like, what kind of a response does it get from you when you find out that your music is resonating with drag performers and they're performing your stuff?
Oh, I mean, it's amazing. Like, you think about any time you put something into the world, the goal is for it to, like, connect with people in unexpected ways, right? That's where things get interesting, because you can, when things go, in a way that you have already anticipated, I don't think it has the same level of, at least for me, impact and excitement. You know, and the beauty of, again, putting things out into the world is that they become other people's things, you know, and they sort of insinuate themselves into other people's lives and other people's art in a manner that is not in your control. And so I'm always just really excited when people are listening to it and then kind of making it their own or doing something that I wouldn't have expected.
So clearly, having your music performed by drag artists is not something that you're like, you know what, I really think that is just a degree of success right there.
Well, I mean, I kind of always make music and I figure, like, no one's going to listen to it, in a way. Like, I know my family will and my friends and stuff, but it's always kind of, like, shocking when I find out that other people, like, are listening to what I'm doing on some level.
Well, I really think that no matter what kind of art form you're producing, whether it's something written or whether it's music or paintings, whatever, when you do it, if you are too conscious about what will resonate with other people, then it's not authentic to begin with. So if you just make the music thinking, you know what, my friends and family will listen to this for obvious reasons, but then you discover other people are, you know, finding it compelling or it's attaching themselves in some way to their lives, then that has to be extra rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, I think you touch on something that is really at the heart of what I'm trying to do, which is, you know, and I've thought about this a lot, like, no matter what you're doing in this world, if it feels true to you and if it feels authentic to the vision of yourself that you have, you kind of never regret it, really. Like, even I can look back on songs that I wrote that were just incredibly sincere and honest, and I can be like, oh man, like, my vocal performance could have been better, or maybe I would have changed the production now. But the spirit of the song I can always feel proud of and can always stand behind. So I, you know, a couple of years ago, really with my first record that I put out, I think reorganized my mind in a way where I was like, I'm only going to make really honest shit, and that's the barometer. You know, it isn't like, does this sound really cool? Is the production super next level? I mean, those things matter, but at the core, you know, do you feel like an asshole singing it on an acoustic guitar. And if you do, and if you feel like it's not, you know, it's not true to you, then don't, like, you should not be doing it.
Right. I think that we often hear of a lot of artists who, 5 years after releasing an album, they're like, yeah, that was something somebody else wanted me to do, and I'm not really happy with it, you know?
So. Yeah. You know, and that's like a pretty, you know, it's sort of an awful feeling. And earlier, you know, in my career, I dealt with a little bit of that, but on a very small scale. And it just showed me like a way that I didn't want to feel.
So when you released Life as a Dog, compared to where you are as you're releasing and kind of rolling out Everywhere Somewhere, what changes have you discovered in yourself that makes the two like a growth for you?
Well, you know, I put out Life as a Dog at this really transitional moment in both life and in my career. You know, I had just left this major label I was on, and I was sort of questioning myself in a lot of very very deep ways, you know, and really wondering if music was what I should continue to be doing. And when I put out Life as a Dog, it did affirm for me that I really love making music, and that if I, you know, continue to look for and trust that kind of like internal compass, that good things will happen as a consequence of that. But I think, you know, since that record, you know, I've expanded upon that philosophy, and I think I've just achieved, and, you know, like, your whole life is about, on some level, you know, knowledge of others and knowledge of self, and those two things develop, I think, sort of like a strand of DNA, you know, it's like they're connected to one another, but I feel like I have a better understanding of who I am, how I want to do things, how I like to make music, the ways in which I can be a productive songwriter. And so that was, you know, that was really helpful in terms of, I think, picking collaborators who I was really well suited to work with, and, you know, who really helped me to realize the vision for a lot of this record. And then on the flip side, you know, after spending 2 years kind of on the road, you know, I think I also got a real sense of what kind of live instrumentation I wanted to have on this record, and definitely feeling like I will, you know, my headspace right now is more in a alt kind of rock dimension. And so that was like, I felt like for me musically, sonically, that was kind of the next step with this release.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I was surprised. My first exposure to you was when I received a promo copy of Blood in the Cut, and that track, for I think in large part, as again, going back to my own personal experience as a drag performer, one of the reasons I love it is because the tempo changes, the everything, you know, it's like, it's very visual in its sound. It has a sound that feels like cinema to me. And then, as a result of my interest in that particular song, I began to explore your back catalog of music, and you've described yourself as genre-defying in the past, but that proved to be so true, because what I heard of your previous music felt almost disconnected from what I felt in the newer music. And what are your thoughts on the perception that that could be true?
Music as part of any scene, and I think as a consequence of that, I've been very, very free and not too worried about where the music that I'm making fits in terms of, you know, like the broader spectrum of music. And so I think, like, you know, that's, I think that makes actually a lot of sense, you know, And I like that there can be, you know, moments. I do feel like, and I hope that, you know, the narrative voice in, you know, across different records can feel like it's me consistently, and it's, you know, it's my perspective, which has remained, you know, pretty consistent throughout the years. But the fact that the music is changing and every release is different, a little bit different from the last, like, you know, I think it's only natural that people are going to connect with certain records and certain songs, you know, way more intensely than they would with others, you know. And some people are going to consume the whole catalog and be, you know, across the board really invested. But I think that, I mean, as a listener of a lot of music too, I think that makes total sense.
Right. I think that one of the things that I perceived after doing a little research, because as an emerging artist, I don't think it's unusual for people to discover one song and then begin to search. You know what I mean? And my awareness of you came after there was a whole album, you know, previous body of work that was available. So, but one of the things I would imagine helped influence that or kept it from being a strict requirement for you to adhere to any sound is that a lot of your earlier work was self-produced and self-released, and there was probably no overarching, you know, governing body saying, no, okay, this is the sound we want you to have. Yeah. This is who you have to be. This is what's going to work. This is what's going to sell.
Yeah, that's 100% true. Yeah, I mean, I was making music in sort of like, you know, I think I'm really grateful for it in a lot of ways, but in some, you know, some, there was an element of isolation to it. And I think, you know, it allowed me to experiment and to put things out into the world and to, you know, to do, like, see what it's like to play, like, a weirdo, really dense rap song live. Like, what does that feel like, you know, for me as a performer and for my interaction with the audience? So it's like, I think I've been just kind of learning along the way. And, you know, again, as I said before, trying to be as authentic to myself as I can with every release, but hopefully, you know, evolving and becoming a more, like, focused, mature artist.
So I know that audiences can actually go out right now and purchase Everywhere Is Somewhere, but for people who are only familiar with perhaps one or two tracks from your past, like, where does this record take them?
Well, I think this record, at least as I honestly, to be perfectly honest with you, I haven't listened to it in quite some time, just because I can't, like, once I'm done with the song, I can't hear it again, but,
ever?
I mean, I have to play it live, so
okay.
I'll hear it, but, like, I'm not the type of person, I don't really want to hear myself too much, so, you know, I'll encounter it. Sometimes, like, I'll probably go back and listen to the full record, like, maybe next week or something. But I sort of needed a break from it. I think this record to me just feels like as I was saying before, like, a more focused version of my music. And I think, like, I mean, I think it's my strongest body of work to date. I'm really proud of it, you know, and I really tried to push the envelope with myself in terms of the instrumentation, and, you know, whereas a lot of the stuff, a lot of my earlier stuff is a bit more, like, minimal, this feels kind of, like, lush to me, and that was one of the goals going into making the record, was for it to feel, you know, like, there was a sonic density to it that I hadn't achieved in the past. You know, and I really attribute that to, you know, I worked with three different producers on this thing, and, you know, they really helped to push me in that direction to explore a lot of that. And, you know, I've ended up finding a lot of joy in doing that. So, yeah, it just feels sounds to me like thematically, from a songwriting perspective and from a sonic perspective, that this is, it's kind of the most realized body of music that I've put out.
I'm still trying to get over the fact that you really haven't listened to it kind of in its entirety since its release, but then...
Well, I mean, I had to listen to it so much,
right?
You know, like, for the mixing and the mastering, and, like, so I know what the album sounds like. And, I mean, the other day we did an in-store performance at Amoeba Records here in L.A., and, like, afterwards when I was signing stuff, they were playing the record. So, like, I've heard it. I just haven't sat down with headphones and, like, properly listened to it.
No, I mean, and I totally got what you were saying in regards to that, but it's, and when I was kind of on the flip side of being a little stunned, like, oh my gosh, this woman has put out this great body of music, but she hasn't actually listened to it, I realized, you know, for audiences around the world, this came out, you know, last week or whatever, and for you, you've been sitting recording this and listening to it probably dozens of times for each track just to get, you know what, I want more of this or more of that, so... It makes sense that you'd almost be kind of sick of your own self, you know.
Well, we were joking that, like, on the artist side, you put out a record and it feels like the finish line in a way, but, like, in terms of the world and everything that's going to happen, it's actually the starting line.
Right.
So it's this really strange thing where, like, you know, creatively you're like, oh, okay, fuck, like, I'm done. Yay. But, you know, in reality, it's only just beginning. But I think it's important to have that kind of space, no matter what you do, because it helps you to, I mean, actually when we were hearing it over the speakers at Amoeba, I was chatting with my guitarist, and we were, like, kind of getting ideas for arrangement stuff for the live show, just because we hadn't listened to the song in a little bit. You know, we've been playing a lot of the records live, but that's its own kind of beast. And, yeah, so it's nice to have a bit of time away and then just to kind of re-encounter it. And I think that helps to, at least for live stuff and, you know, for broken down sets and for reimagining the songs, it's quite helpful to do that.
Oh, of course. And, you know, it's one of the, it harkens back to your earlier comment that you have to put out music that you are proud of down the road because you have to live with this music. You know, you have to be performing this potentially a career long, you know, experience. So if you're putting out music that you don't like by the time it comes out, then certainly 3 years later when people are like, I want you to play blah, 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 you know, and you're like, I didn't really like that song when it came out, you know. So it's much more beneficial. So... when you were at Stanford studying psychology and sociology, music was never a factor for you. It never played into an option as your career, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, you know, college was when I was beginning to experiment with music and really encountering it in this, like, deep emotional way, both as a listener and then as somebody who was starting to make it. So it was a very formative period in that way. But yeah, no, I was a very serious student and kind of assumed I would continue on in academia in some way, you know, to go on and get another degree and then figure out what I was going to do. All because I love school. And, like, the structure of school and everything about it is very appealing to me. You know, and then it wasn't until after college, I was living in San Francisco and kind of experiencing, I think, I was sort of opening myself up to the world in a few different ways, and I think that coincided with me starting to... You know, I was really spending time working on music and getting better and playing around the city. And I think once I started, like, playing shows and making a little bit of money, not a lot of money, I started to feel like it was something I could maybe do. And I was starting to get, you know, feedback from, like, people who weren't just my friends.
Right.
That they liked it, You know, like, that I sort of was starting to sense that, like, I could, what I was making could potentially connect with people who weren't obligated to connect with me. And it was just, it felt like, you know, I've looked back and thought about it, but it just feels like I was, like, slowly rolling down a hill. There's never a moment where I was like, this is what I'm gonna do, and no one can fucking stop me. It was just like, after 2 years, I was like, well, I'm kind of doing this. And then, like, I got a record deal and blah, blah, blah. And then I had money to, you know, live, and I could quit my job and all that. But, yeah, it wasn't until, you know, I think I really started to live on my own as a non-college student adult and figure out who I wanted to be, sort of.
Wow, I of course I live in San Francisco, and I find this to be a very well. I would love to say it's continuing to be an artistically creative and free city, but we both know that, you know, the cost is really killing us artists around here. But anyway, it's like I do find it to be a great space to meet other people who are creative and to hone your creative and artistic talents. The space is so embracing of that.
Totally. Well, and it's, you know, it's small enough, too. And I think that's, like, because I moved, well, after I lived in San Francisco for this couple of years, I moved to New York, which obviously is a very large, extremely large city. And it made me really appreciate that kind of incubation that was able to occur in San Francisco, you know, where it does feel like you do know people. In whatever world or set of worlds you're in, you know, it's small enough where there is that sense of community and camaraderie. And I think that's really important and really helpful for a lot of people, you know, doing creative things, you know, to feel like you're not just a speck of dust and, you know, floating around a giant room.
When you were here, you know, doing the artistic thing and creative thing, how much overlap for you was there with the extremely prominent LGBT community in this city?
I mean, it was funny because, like, I think when you're making art and performing and just being like a human in the Bay Area, You sort of take for granted the fact that, like, at least in my experience, you know, our friend group was incredibly, and my kind of, like, everything group was incredibly diverse in the sense of, you know, a huge portion of that was LGBT, a huge portion, you know, were people who were super creative, some people were, like all into tech, all, you know, it just felt like there was a lot of openness and a lot of mixing in the city. Like, that was my experience. And so, you know, that was kind of my status quo. And I think being in the Bay, you know, I really appreciate so many elements of the LGBT scene there. And I think, again, when we talk about that, like, kind of supportive, open space to make stuff, I think that's, like, a huge part of why the city is like that. At least to me, that always struck me as a huge part of it. So, yeah, it's kind of just always been, I think, a part of the, you know, my early musical experience, and then really became something that I valued, in terms of, you know, my audience and the people who were engaging with whatever I was doing.
I love the fact that you talk about, because, you know, I think that sometimes I'll talk to artists or whatever, and they will come to recognize, for example, that their music has gained an LGBT following, and they value and appreciate that. And of course, as a drag queen, a gay man, I appreciate and value the fact that they recognize us. But you talk about the fact of something that I am so familiar with as a almost 20-year resident of San Francisco, is that you would have to almost go out of your way, if you live here, to not find your social circle extremely inclusive, whether that's people of color, different ethnicities, you know, different people on the social, the sexuality spectrum, the gender spectrum. I do love that about this city, you know, and I think it fosters a sense among people here that we're kind of all fighting this big fight together, and you can find anyone and everyone here.
Oh my God, totally. You know, and I just think, you know, having lived there and spent time in the Bay for these, like, really crucial years of my development, like 18 to 24, I guess, 25, you know, it's like, that's when you're kind of learning how to be a human being.
And absolutely.
How, you know, like, you're sort of, you're in this moment developmentally that's so important, and I just look back and I'm really, really grateful. You know, I grew up in the Midwest, and then to come to the Bay and just be immersed in this incredibly singular place in that way was, I think, hugely important for me, just as like a human being.
Right, and of course, I would have to say that your studies in sociology and psychology at Stanford, which is, you know, not only liberal, but very forward thinking in terms of the way that they address matters of sociological importance and psychological importance, probably gives you a far different perspective on life to begin with than some people who come from a much more sheltered or backward thinking tone, I guess.
Yeah, I think definitely, you know, I do believe that beyond like your specific area of study, I think if the people in your life, the institutions in your life, like whatever, I don't think you need to go to college to have this, but I think ideally, you know, the baseline for everybody should be extreme curiosity. Like, I just think that, you know, when you think about like little kids, like that's their orientation to the world is like, what is this? Why is this? You know, and throughout our lives, I think that curiosity can be crushed in a lot of ways, and you know, my experience at Stanford, beyond, you know, my specific area of study, was really one of fostering creativity and, you know, being open and humble, you know, because to be curious, right, is to sort of presume that you don't know everything and that there's like wonderment that awaits. And I think that's like, you know, kind of a useful outlook on life.
Well, I've always been taught that one of the basic definitions of the word humble or humility is to be teachable. You know what I mean? It's to understand that there's entire sectors of the world that I know nothing about. And if I go through life so full of myself that I think I know everything, then there's so much that not only will I not learn, but people won't even attempt to educate me on, you know?
Yeah.
So something that you said really stands out to me. You love the structure of academia. And one of the things that I would think is almost polar opposite in terms of structure would be life as an artist, as a traveling musician. I mean, surely there's structure with that, but, you know, different times of shows and different, you know, every day is a different schedule. And how does that work for you as a personality?
Well, it's been a pretty massive change. You know, I think throughout most of my youth and college included, yeah, I really sought like a lot of solace in structure as a way to cope with, you know, I think there's like many, many ways to cope with anxiety and the sort of dark spectrum of human emotionality. And for me, for a long time, a very regimented existence was the answer to that. And I think in a like spiritual, psychic way or something, I think I was drawn to music because a part of me knew that it would force me to break out of that and to confront some of these things head on instead of, you know, creating like structures to, you know, to keep my mind secure. So it's been like a complete 180, But I think you reach this point, and I've talked to a lot of musicians about this, you reach a point where you have fully embraced the chaos, and it sort of, once that occurs, it's a pretty liberating, it's like kind of a liberating moment.
Right, well, I mean...
I'm so sorry, we need to wrap this up.
Oh, Martha.
I'm so sorry.
You're always a Debbie Downer, Martha.
He has a long day.
I know. You know what? I'm just going to wrap this up by saying I am grateful for this opportunity to speak with you. And, you know, Kay, I'm sure that you've already picked up on it, but Martha is one of my favorite fruit flies. She loves the gays. I love her. And she always presents me with amazing opportunities like this. So I'm really grateful that you talked to me today.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time. And, say hi to the city for me.
I will. So thanks for joining us, and I will talk to you later. Best of luck. That was singer Kay Flay. Her new album, Everywhere Is Somewhere, came out on April 7th. Go pick it up or download it at your favorite online retailer. We'll be back with more Party Foul Radio right after this.
Hey, y'all. This is Bob the Drag Queen. You are listening to Party Foul Radio with Toyo Del Mar and Pearl. Listen up, girl.
Welcome back to Party Foul Radio. I'm your co-host, Poet Del Mar, and I'm joined at this time by filmmaker Max Gogarty. Max's acclaimed 2015 documentary, Chemsex, explores the intersection between gay male sexuality and intravenous drug use in the underground scenes of London. It's considered a very raw and emotionally charged look at the effect and impact of crystal meth addiction and usage on gay male sexuality, as well as the spread of HIV, while following one British social worker who's made it his life's mission to help these men from their addictions. And it will be showing this weekend, April 22nd and 23rd in the San Francisco Bay Area. I will be joining the panel discussion as well as leading that discussion on Saturday the 22nd at Oakland's New Parkway Theater, and again at the Women's Building on the 23rd of April in San Francisco from 1 to 4 p.m. Please welcome to Party Foul Radio, Max Gogarty. Oh my God, you are really cute. Sorry, I had no idea that you were so adorable. So tell me a little bit, of course we're talking about your film Chemsex, and I was curious why it was that of all the subject matter that you could have selected that you chose to make your first film about crystal meth, the epidemic that we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't actually my first film. It's my first big film, so it's like, you know, first feature documentary. But it wasn't a conscious decision to do it. It was it kind of came around over time. So I was working at Vice at the time, and we started looking into this issue. I met David Stewart, who features heavily in the film, who had just, like, taken up a job at 56 Dean Street, which is London's kind of most important sexual health well-being clinic for gay men. And I got chatting to him, and once I'd spoken to him, and he told me about what was happening in London, and it was a very, very underreported story. It was an unreported story. No one was talking about it. No one in the mainstream media certainly hadn't touched it. So I just started looking into it. Me and Will, my co-director, we just started kind of filming stuff and looking into it and building up some access and some relationships. And then it kind of grew and grew and grew over time. It wasn't, we never set out to make a feature film. We set out to, like, make like a 5-minute documentary or like something. And then it just, over the space of 2 years, it just developed into what it became.
Yeah, it's one of the things that you say that it's not being reported on by media in the United Kingdom, or specifically London, where the film is set, but...
It wasn't before. It is now.
Okay, so hold on. You know what? Hold on just a second, Max, because I'm like in this area. I'm trying to find a quiet space because I was out and about. I'm in the Castro, and I am like having some connectivity issues, and I'm hoping that if I come closer to where there is Wi-Fi, that we will be able to
hear each other a little more clearly. So, but I'm embarrassed to tell you where I'm recording this. I'm actually, a friend of mine manages an adult toy shop in the Castro, and it was the only place that I could think of that would be completely private and quiet on an afternoon. Yes, it is, if that's okay.
Cool.
Well, I host a podcast.
Yeah.
A rather popular global LGBT podcast. And of course, I also contribute to the Huffington Post, so there's a large possibility that some of this will be ending up on the Huffington Post, so.
Okay, cool. And you are emceeing the panel on the weekend, right?
Yes, I'm going to be emceeing both events, so.
Great.
And it was very interesting how that came about, because they contacted me, I think, just because of the fact that, you know, they told me that you guys wanted to sort of make the viewing specific to whatever areas you were going to. And as it turns out, like, this film subject matter hits very closely to home, because I have a personal history of kind of that downward spiral that you, you know, kind of depict in the film. And of course, I'm one of the lucky ones, because I managed to pull myself out of that, and not everybody does, you know?
Yeah.
So you guys decided to make a feature-length film once you had developed the relationships and started to find out background on this. How did you guys go about getting people who were willing to discuss this on film? Because, you know, this is something that many people, even if they're actively involved in, like, an addiction or the practice, don't necessarily want on film.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, took a lot of time, and we were, you know, it's interesting, the first thing we ever filmed was the interviews, that feature that formed the kind of the chorus and the spine of the film, which are all, you know, either in front or behind the red curtain, and they're just testimonies and you know, talking straight to camera. So that was the first thing we ever filmed, is we put out a kind of open invitation to people to come down and talk to us and tell them about their experiences with sex and drugs in London, to come and talk to Vice about it. And they could choose whether to be either anonymous, so, you know, they might have their faces shown and sit behind the curtain, or they could be in front of the curtain and talk to us. So that was the first thing we ever filmed. And we thought maybe like one or two people maximum would turn up to that, but a lot of people came. A lot of people wanted to share their stories. A lot of people chose to sit in front of the curtain. And from then, that moment, and I mean, certainly those few days, me and Will shooting those interviews, when we finished that, we felt like, wow, like, we have to tell the story and we have to make this film, and wouldn't it be amazing if we could follow some of these people in their lives? And so it's not just the interviews, but it's their own experiences and, you know, their actual lives, what's happening. So some of the people we interviewed that day, we followed up with and asked them if we could come and hang out, and they let us, and they formed the spine of the film, the main people we follow. And we had, you know, we built up a relationship of trust over a long period of time. We had a policy with all the people who were in it, whereby they could pull out of filming at any time if they felt like they didn't want to be part of it anymore. So we were quite lucky in that we had time, and we had that, you know, kind of trust. And we made it at a very specific time that, you know, if we'd been 6 months later or 6 months earlier, we probably wouldn't have got the access we did. But it felt like there was a kind of London in the way it was at a tipping point in 2015, where no one was really talking about the issue, but everyone was certainly feeling it and experiencing it. And the people in the film were incredibly brave for agreeing to do it, you know.
You know, it's very interesting that the theme of this film, being as it is, covers a topic that's very specific
And individual is very specific to London, but the reality that we're seeing is that crystal meth epidemic is striking all over the world. You know, I was on tour in Taiwan not too long ago and noted that it was, you know, problematic even there, which seems somewhat unusual to me. And then when I went to the Philippines after that, the same. You know, it's like something that crosses all boundaries. There is no lines of delineation between Eastern and Western or anything like that.
Yeah. That's what I hear. It's incredibly, you know, it's an incredibly pervasive drug. And I mean, you know, crystal meth is certainly not confined to the LGBT community, right? It's like, it's absolutely been, I think, associated much more in culture with the straight scene. And I think what was important that we get across with the film is it wasn't any specific drug that was causing the problems in London on its own. It was the mixture of these drugs that were relatively new to London and the gay community, and it was the mixture of those drugs with other things that were going on. So the rise of apps and dating apps, plus you know, other things, other deep-rooted issues. That led to this kind of, you know, perfect storm in which it really takes hold and takes root. But yeah, I think, you know, crystal meth, wherever it goes, is pretty horrific, isn't it? And dangerous.
Yes, very much so. I loved one of the things from the film's one of the film's trailers that really struck me was that it talked about gay men who have some personal insecurities that are dealing with these much more deep-rooted issues that, whether that's the personal stigma or internalized homophobia or issues relating to other gay men sexually, that the drugs allow them to overcome. And you really explore a lot of those issues in the film. And I was wondering if you could kind of talk about some of the things that came to light for you as a filmmaker from doing so.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that, again, like, didn't expect to be a part of the, you know, initially we approached this film very much as a drugs documentary. It was like, wow, crystal meth's big in London all of a sudden and very confined to a specific, you know, perhaps vulnerable community. So let's have a look at this. But then what happened is we learned from everyone we were talking to that it was more than that. It was more, you can't just blame it on the drug, you can't just blame it on the apps. It's much more complicated. And, you know, I think from all the people that we've spoken to, we're talking about, as you say, issues around, you know, internalized homophobia or gay shame or growing up, you know, and the way in which the AIDS epidemic was kind of, you know, medically treated as opposed to it being more about well-being and about, you know, spiritual and emotional support as much as medical. And I think, you know, that trauma and that collective kind of experience has very much informed a lot of the decisions, at least, or not even decisions, a lot of the subconscious kind of actions that some of the people we followed experienced.
Yeah, I definitely think that for many people, I think that because our community was so traumatized emotionally from the AIDS epidemic, a lot of people turned to drugs and alcohol as a means of decreasing the inhibitions which are inherent in them as a community that is much more aware of HIV and AIDS and is much more aware of the other ramifications that our predecessors faced from expressing themselves sexually. What has been your response as you travel the world showing your film and leading panel discussions like the one that we will be having here in San Francisco over the course of the weekend?
I'm really excited because, you know, for me, bringing it to San Francisco is an incredibly special and important thing. I personally haven't been to the US with it. David has and Will has, so I'm excited. The response everywhere we go is different. Very different. Like we've been all over the place. You know, although the issues are somewhat universal and a lot, and everyone seems to be able to connect with the subject matter, and certainly, you know, one of the things what often David does, you know, not necessarily me, but when he's whenever we're on a panel together, he'll often ask the people in the audience whether they or someone they know have been affected by the issues in the film. And wherever you go, people seem to be, you know, disproportionately knowledgeable of PMP or chemsex. So, I mean, you know, we've been incredibly surprised at how far it's travelled and the impact it's had and still having nearly two years later now since we first premiered it. And I think it's because, you know, it's not an easy film to watch by any you know, means. It doesn't pull any punches. It's hard. It was hard to make, and we wanted that to reflect. We wanted our experiences making it and the experiences of the people in it to be authentically in the most visceral and, you know, real way possible. It's documentary. It's not, you know, it's not comedy or, you know, it's not fluffy. You know, it's real life. And so I think everyone's affected by it and moved by it in some way. And I guess the thing that we want to take the film, people hopefully to take out the film, is for it to start a discussion wherever we go with it, to start discussions, to get people to open up, to get people to talk, for people to realise that the people in the film, how brave and honest they were to participate, is now having an impact on local, you know, communities all around the world, hopefully getting them to talk and open up about it, because certainly from my experience making it and speaking to people who've been affected by it, bottling it up doesn't work.
Yeah. I mean, I was forewarned in advance of this weekend's screenings of it that, you know, and nobody had to tell me. I know that the subject matter is intense, and it's sometimes the stories are dire. They generally, as I mentioned earlier, as a person who has gone down this road myself, I am aware that breaking that cycle of addiction, breaking that cycle of usage, and the link between drugs and sex and drugs is one that many people never make. You know what I mean? It is quite intense. And I was informed that it'll be my responsibility to somehow bring levity to it. And I think that the only thing that will allow me to do that is the fact that I've experienced it. And I know some of the, you know, even in the most dire situations, there is some humor to be found, you know? So hopefully we can do that. It's, you know, I'm sure that you have, you know, you've already indicated, actually, that you built strong bonds and relationships with the people that you showcase in the film. And how much follow-up have you had with them since its premiere in 2015?
I mean, we had a fair bit, you know, after the film, you know, for probably about 6 months or a year afterwards, we were talking to everyone pretty much, because it was so, you know, and they were with us on a lot of the panels, and, you know, a number of people in them appeared that, were involved with discussions and Q&As and so on. You know, probably less so in the last year. I mean, you know, I think, you know, we get updates and we hear how people are doing, but you know, and I certainly, me and David is an incredibly close friend to me now, and I see Dave often, but regarding the people in the film, as you can imagine, it's quite hard to stay in touch with people who perhaps haven't broken that cycle, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I 100% understand that. A new phone number every 3 months, disappearing, transient. Besides the fact that I know from firsthand experience that, quite honestly, when you are in that cycle, days become weeks, become months, and you don't even know that you have been out of contact for, you know. Tragically, I can tell you, when I was in the height of my personal addiction, I didn't speak to my dad one time for 3 years and had no idea that that's how long it had been. And that's horrendous to acknowledge now in retrospect, but I didn't recognize it, you know? So.
Yeah. And you know, I know, forgive me for asking, but, like, how did you find yourself eventually breaking that cycle?
I personally
went to rehab. I put myself in rehab. And I am, you know, I did an extended stay in rehab. I got significant aftercare in terms of therapy and support groups and things of that nature. And I actively maintain those techniques of recovery. You know, I'm part of a recovery community that's here in San Francisco. And I, you know, I recognize that every time I do log on to one of those apps or go out to a nightclub, I know that if I choose to make that decision, the drug is waiting right there for me. That culture and lifestyle that I put behind is still prevalent. It's, you know, it's not even all new faces. Sometimes it's the same old faces, but I recognize for myself that it's something that I just don't want. And I have to do everything I possibly can to keep from returning to that. Just as, for example, if somebody lost a significant amount of weight, for we'll say, and recognized that health and fitness and nutrition were all important to maintaining that, I have to do the same things to maintain the break between me and the lifestyle that I lived in terms of drugs and alcohol for years. Yeah. It sounds like a morbid question, but given my personal experience, even in the short 2-year period, has there been anybody who has actually lost their battle to the addiction? Anybody that we see on screen?
Thankfully, no. Thank God.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's a morbid question, but it's one that when people fall into that depths of whether it's the despair that often comes with addiction or just the abuse of oneself, there. Especially if people are HIV positive or things of that nature, it's just such a reality that it had to be asked.
Of course, absolutely.
Now,
yeah, I mean, a hell of a lot. I've heard about a hell of people who haven't been so lucky who we met through the film, but not in the film. But as far as I know, all the main people in the film are doing quite well.
Well, that is certainly a relief. I mean, it's a tragic reality that we all face. And, you know, like I can't tell you the number of people here in San Francisco that I've known to either overdose or super tragically take their own lives because they feel that that cycle cannot be broken, that they feel that there is no escape, and that while they may not have the desire to actually die, they don't have the initiative to keep on living the way that they have been.
Yeah. You see it as a massive issue in San Francisco at the moment, or it always has been?
Well, I will tell you that I have been drug and alcohol free for, by the time this airs, we release this on Wednesday, April 19th, and as of Thursday, April 20th, 2017, I'll be celebrating 13 years drug and alcohol free.
Amazing. Congratulations.
So don't congratulate me just yet, Max. But the point being that I was really deep in that world 13 years ago. So it's been there and ongoing since that time. So I think that it is probably equally prevalent now. You know what I mean? It's not something that just sprang up overnight. So, yeah, it's at. Have there been thoughts about doing a follow up to this film?
Not yet. I mean, it's still kind of doing its own thing in a way. At some point, maybe, but I think the certainly in London, it feels like, you know, what we were trying to do, which is get the idea of chemsex and the idea that this is happening on the agenda in terms of making sure that at least, you know, the healthcare providers and sexual health clinics and drug workers were all around the country, not just in London, were aware of these issues so they could perhaps offer better, more specialised, more suitable care to people who present and need help. It feels as though, I hope, that has somewhat been achieved, not down to our film, but hopefully it's just on its own, but hopefully it had a part to play in it. But I think there are different things happening and new things happening all the time, of course, and I think I would love to, you know, continue making films that have as much impact and feel as though they have as much public purpose as this, I think, has.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting here in San Francisco, our in the Castro district, which is our gay district, of course, and our primary sexual health provider is a nonprofit organization called Strut. It's an STD clinic for all intents and purposes, but they are very closely affiliated with various programs that also help break drug addiction cycles or practice harm reduction and things like that. So I think that having in major metropolitan areas like London or San Francisco, New York, other places around the world, having a connection between those types of organizations is so important because, as your film shows, there is a direct correlation. Oh, dear. Somebody's phone's ringing. There is a direct correlation between the two, you know, so.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Okay. Anyway, I'm stashed in the storeroom of this dildo store talking to you. It's a very romantic moment for us, Max.
I know, it's amazing. I'm picturing it. I can't see it, but sounds brilliant.
I only wish you could see the fact that I literally am sitting in front of three boxes labeled with big, giant stickers, free condoms from the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. So, it's all very appropriate and highly ironic in some ways. So, you will be flying into San Francisco on Thursday, I'm told.
Friday.
And we'll be together in Oakland on Saturday and here in San Francisco on Sunday. And I am looking forward to it.
So am I. Sounds great. Look forward to meeting you.
I do as well. And thank you for, you know, shining a light on a subject matter that is of vast importance to the LGBTQ community. And I really look forward to having an opportunity to sit on a panel with you and discuss it here in the Bay Area.
Me too. Look forward to it.
All right. Bye.
Thank you. See you soon. Bye.
Oh my God, if you could only see how damn cute he is, you guys. That's Max Gogarty, who is the director and producer of Chemsex. It is a documentary film based on the correlation and impact of crystal meth on queer sex, specifically within the gay male community. It will be showing here in the Bay Area on Saturday in Oakland and Sunday at the Women's Building in San Francisco on 18th Street. I will be on a panel discussing that, and I'll have more details later in this podcast.
Hi, this is Kathy Sledge, and you're listening to Party Foul Radio. And we are family.
All right, everybody, that was Max Gogarty, or Gogarty, the director of Chemsex. It'll be coming here for two showings in the Bay Area. You're listening to Party Foul Radio. I'm Poyet Almar.
And I'm Pearl Teeth.
You guys, while we were listening to those pre-recorded interviews, some news popped up on my phone, and I was like, girl. Oh, good. And Pearl's like, what?
It says Missy 11-year-old Pleasanton boy.
And I was like, oh, good. And then she's like, good, because he's missing? I was like, no, bitch. It says he was found safe.
I didn't see that, girl.
Yeah, because she's always trying to read a hoe.
No, girl. Just because Poyo Del Mar is a sick bitch.
She said, I was going to say, you are a sick bitch. So, I need to give a quick shout out to my baby daddy, Gerald Borjas at Chaps in the Castro. That is the much acclaimed dildo/adult toy store where I recorded my interview with Max. Thank you, baby daddy, for coming through and giving me a place to record my interview privately. That back room, full of condoms, girl, just full of condoms. Perfect to go with our Swiss Navy Lube sponsor. Oh my gosh. This weekend upcoming, what do you have, Pearl? What's on your agenda for the weekend?
I am actually getting some tattoo work done. I'm finishing my sleeve on my left arm. Yeah.
The whole sleeve?
The whole sleeve. I'm going to do like the line work and some of the shading, and then I'll have to go in possibly within another 2 weeks to do like the coloring and everything else. Finally, I'm so excited. It's my little birthday gift to myself. And I have to get it done soon because my artist, who is out in Oakland, is moving, in August or September. So I need this done so I don't have like a bunch of different artists on one arm. But I did want to let you guys know, since we were talking pageants earlier, they've updated the Miss Premier International website, and you can find me on their pay on the website and stuff as their current reigning, with links to my social media accounts and all that stuff. So check that out at MissPremierInternational.com.
Oh, look at that. Very good. And, of course, those are the new photos that Jose took for you, right?
No. That's just photos from, like, from me winning that night. That's the day of. They'll probably update that after they're putting, like, their logos and stuff on the pictures that I just put up from Jose that I put out last night.
That's Jose Guzman Colon, you guys, my drag dad.
Miss Putinesca.
Putinesca.
Who is only here for a few more weeks, you guys. So book your shoots.
That's true.
Right, like as soon as possible, girl.
Yep. At the end of this month, actually, I have a show, like her going away show is going to be...
I will be there.
At San Francisco Oasis on Saturday...
The 23rd,
29th.
Right? Oh, the 29th.
Yes. April 29th is going to be her going away show at the Oasis nightclub. And, ooh. Meanwhile, you guys, this weekend is going to be... This couple of weeks for me has, like, been really busy. I've got some side projects I'm working on. I'm trying... Girl, we were supposed to announce, like... We were supposed to confirm and lock down a date for our damn lube wrestling.
Yeah, so what was the date, girl?
Well, I don't know. We don't have a date for lube wrestling yet. And we've been promising you the Swiss Navy and Party Foul Radio presents lube wrestling for charity at the San Francisco Eagle. I really just need to, like, what date did you say that you wanted?
Girl, I said sometime early in May.
Well, we want late in May or beginning of June so that we can promote it properly.
Well, now properly, considering we're, like, April's almost over.
Okay, Let's ask about...
Let me look at my calendar.
Do you want to ask about June 3rd?
June 3rd, girl.
That's a Saturday, June 3rd.
That will have every single weekend of my June booked. Let's not do that.
Bitch! Listen to her. She wants new shit, but now, girl, that'll be every single weekend
Every single weekend in June is booked except for that weekend for me. I want one weekend off. What about the 28th and the 27th of May?
No, girl. That is Memorial Day weekend.
That means there's going to be a lot of people there.
Girl, that means also a lot of people are going to be out of town because of white party and other stuff.
You think so? Well.
Yeah.
Because, I kind of think people would show up.
I think that we should go for June 3rd. We should ask for June 3rd, and if not, June 10th. What are you doing on June 10th?
June 10th, and I am out of town that weekend for my step down.
Oh, my God.
I'll be in Seattle.
That's a mess.
And then the following week, I am going to be, I'm going to be at my first lesbian wedding.
Okay. What are you doing on May 20th?
May 20th. I don't have anything for May 20th.
All right, you guys, I'm going to put in a request for either May 20th or June 3rd.
Fine.
And we will have...
I still think we should consider the 27th, though, but...
No,
You should ask them if they usually have a good turnout, and if they do...
Okay, well...
We'll get back to you guys.
Now at least you know the time frame we're looking at. If you're in the Bay Area, you need to come on out, because, girl... Hello, Ellen Friedman was giving us all the tips on how to make our lube wrestling for charity a success without injuring any bitches.
Right.
So, ooh, speaking of which, all of our sponsors... Oh, Pearl, did you see that GuideToGay.com in Australia is now officially sharing our podcast?
Yay!
You guys, we are now officially partnered with GuideToGay.com.
Come on, GuideToGay.com.
Yes, Australia's premier LGBT website is now promoting our podcast.
I live.
Yes, girl, I'm hopeful that we can get, wouldn't it be delightful, you guys, if Swiss Navy Lube next year when they go back for gay Mardi Gras.
Mm-hmm.
Was able to take Party Foul Radio with them because we've got this working relationship with GuideToGay.com.
I would learn how to death drop just for you guys.
Oh, my God. I just remember. So when I was in Sacramento, you guys, all these queens came into my hotel room while I was, like, trying to get ready. And they're, like, watching TV. So they were watching some, like, Olympic. No, it wasn't Olympics gymnastics. It was, like, collegiate gymnastics routines.
Okay.
There was, the national, like, the NCAA gymnastics for the collegiate people was on. So how come they had all these girls, whatever, and then this one sassy black girl comes up who's like wearing, her wig was horrible, but she obviously had on a wig, and her whole routine was like infused with Vogue moves. And then, bitch, at the end, you know she death dropped. We all shrieked. We were like, yes, bitch, yes! House of LaBeija, bitch! House of LaBeija! So, anyway.
Oh, God.
So, at any rate, I think it'd be super fierce, bitch.
I would live, girl.
To, like, for us.
I got my passport. I'm ready.
Yes, I got my passport too, boo. So, we will,
So, go and check out our sponsors, Swiss Navy Lubricants, GuideToGay.com.
That's Guide 2, the number 2.
Oh, come on, number 2Gay.com.
I think it's Guide 2 Gay.
While she figures that out, don't forget to check out our sponsors over at Daddy's Barbershop.
Girl, I need to go in and get my head shaved. And you maybe do. My back shaved.
You do.
That's true. So, Arlen and Jesse at Daddy's Barbershop, we love you and thank you for all your support. Of course, check out Left Magazine at liveleft.com, and visit Guide to Gay. It is actually the letters T-O.
Girl, I'm outed.
GuideToGay.com.
You don't send them to the wrong website.
Bitch, just look it up, GuideToGay.com. It's Australia's premier LGBT website, bitch. We need to start. I'm going to be looking for every country's premier website, gay website.
Yeah, let's get on it. I'm down.
Yeah, I think it'd be fierce. But we are so grateful. Thank you, Robert, at GuideToGay.com for partnering with us. And... hello, Mimi, I'm first. Get back to me, you bitch, because we are trying to promote this cruise of Cuba. I want bitches to join me on this cruise to Cuba because I'm going to go. My best friend and...
going on a cruise to Cuba?
Yes, bitch, yes.
You're a bitch. When?
I am going on a cruise to Cuba in December. The December cruise to Cuba.
Oh, that sounds cold.
Say what? To Cuba?
You think Cuba doesn't get cold?
It's in the Caribbean, bitch.
Well?
Girl, they sail out of Miami to Cuba. It's hot as fuck in Cuba.
Well, let me know how it goes.
Girl, all I can tell you is I know how it's going to go. It's going to go uncut Latin cock as far as the eye can see. I'm...
And you know Pollo is like... It has, like, cobwebs and shit growing in her fucking basement.
Not after this last weekend, girl. Come on, Sacramento.
Ew, you are so nasty. I don't even want to know.
Anyway, you guys, next week, remember, we're going to be back with Andy Bell from Erasure and much more on another Party Foul Radio. This is the end of this episode, bitches.
All right.
Come out and catch me at those screenings at ChemSex over the weekend. Meet Max Gogarty in person, the director. And, oh, girl, he is so cute. He is so... cute. Yes.
Come through.
So, anyway, I'm Poet Almar.
And I'm Pearl Tease.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.